Hello, everyone. This is Dr. Pamela Brewer welcoming you to this edition of Mind Talk. I am very pleased to introduce to you today a very special guest, a woman who has a long history locally and nationally, Lorne Cress Love. And for those of you who are unaware, and I suspect that's maybe one person on the planet, Lorne Cress Love is also the sister of our very recently departed Dr. Frances Cress Welsing. Lorne Cress Love, welcome to Mind Talk.
And thank you very much for the invitation, and I'm glad to be here.
Well, again, I have to say that I am quite honored to have you. And I'm going to start off being at nosy, because that's what I like to do, and ask you about where you were born and what your early experiences were like, both for yourself personally and within your family and, of course, with your sisters.
Well, our family is from Chicago. I was born in Chicago as well as my sister, and our parents were Chicagoans, which is maybe a little bit unusual because many early Chicagoans came from the South, but both our parents on both sides, our grandparents came from, well, one grandparent came from Mississippi, but my maternal grandmother, my maternal grandfather came from Canada, and our paternal grandparents were from North Carolina and also from Ohio. So we kind of have a mixture of family coming to Chicago early on, and they came as early as 1887 for my father's mother, and as early as 1903 for my grandparents. So we are longtime Chicagoans and have deep roots there originally, and that's where we grew up. Our father was a physician and our mother was a school teacher. And although they were professional people, we lived in a black community, an old black community, and we were just part of the community. We were not special in that sense. Our family, we were just part of, you know, a very old black community.
Now, you just said, although they were professionals, you lived in a black community. Were there those who expected that your family would live elsewhere as a result of your parents' professions?
Not in those days.
Okay.
Not necessarily in those days. Back at in the 20s, my parents, I was born in 1934, Frances, 35. My parents were married in 1930, I think, 30, yeah. But back in those days, communities, the black community in many cities was a community of all kinds of people, you know, professional people and just really worker people. It was not a separated community as it later became,
yes,
maybe after the Second World War, when other housing opportunities became available. And I know that there were real housing shortages in the 30s and 40s for African-American people. And as things began to open up, people perhaps with other income or better, more income, may have moved out of the predominantly black community, but we stayed until we were forced out.
Until
we
you
were literally probably the first victims, let's say, of what is now called gentrification in America, where our neighborhood was totally condemned I forget how many blocks, but it was condemned and as a slum. And then we were forced out. Didn't matter how much money or property you owned, you had to leave. And so that was our early experience in being forced out of neighborhoods. But actually, it wasn't the very first experience for anyone in our family, because my mother's father, my grandfather, who came to Chicago in 1893 and met and married my grandmother, had a grocery store in the area that is now Hyde Park in Chicago, which is the area of the University of Chicago.
I see.
And that area had obviously must have had a number of African Americans, but Hyde Park incorporated as a township and created a restricted covenant, which meant that only certain people were permitted to own or live in that area. And that restricted covenant restricted African Americans. So my grandfather was forced out of that neighborhood and then bought a house, actually in Chicago, 3149 Ellis, in 1909, where we lived until, not we, originally my grandfather and grandmother and my mother and her brothers and sisters. But ultimately, when my parents married, my grandparents moved to another location, and my mother and father lived in that house. So essentially, my mom had been in that house from 1906 until, or maybe 1909, I would say 1909, until around 1953, when we had to move and were forced out of that community.
So certainly your family and you, it seems like, have experienced the joys of being African American in this country since the very beginning.
The what?
The joys.
The what did you say?
I put it in quotes, though. You just
the
didn't
joys
see
of being African American.
Yeah.
Did you say?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, yes, I would say we have experienced, and I guess what I would say, a background of experiences in terms of family-wise, in terms of being African American in America. My great-grandfather. My grandfather that I mentioned, who was from Canada, my great-grandfather, his father, came to Chicago in 1863 and joined the Union Army and fought in the Civil War. He came down from Canada, and there was a Union Army base in Chicago at that time, and he joined up there and then fought in the Civil War, and then returned to Canada, and then his oldest son, my grandfather, my mother's father, came to Chicago in 1893 for the Columbian Exposition, and ultimately met and married my grandmother, and had a grocery store first, and then he had other businesses, and then later created a funeral home that was a part of our family for many, many, many years.
Mm-hmm. Now, Lauren, I mean, clearly lots of rich experiences for yourself and your family. Were these experiences what brought you to the path of becoming a community organizer?
Well, I'm not sure. You know, our mother was, besides being a teacher, a public school teacher for many, many years, actually about 45 years, was always involved in community activity. And prior to that, I would say my grandparents, through the church, My grandfather was head of the Deacon and Trustee Board of Oliver Baptist Church for over 50 years, and that was one of the oldest black Baptist churches in Chicago. And my grandmother was very involved in church work. So I guess you could kind of say that our family was always involved in one way or another in community, in activity away or outside of the home, but related to our community. So, you know, when you grow up in a family, you just grow up in that family. You don't see it as unusual. You just are a member of a family, and whatever that family does, you're involved in it. You're not conscious of how you are affected or how, as a result of what the family does. That's not a conscious thing unless you step back and look and say, as you review, well, yes, I guess I did this because. But in your everyday livingness, I said, go along with the program, so to speak. You know, you're just there, and you're pulling in and certainly influenced, but it's not a conscious influence. You're just doing what one does. And so as I look at, as I step back and look at certain aspects of my livingness as well as my sister's livingness, I can see many things that we just did as a result of what happened in our family. My mother, who died at the age of 93, was and retired from Chicago Public Schools after teaching 45 years, and then spent the rest of her life organizing and working in the community. My mother had her own campaign called Keep Chicago Clean, and she had her buttons made, and she distributed these buttons at talks in schools or to groups or to whomever. And so this was part of her campaign. And so when I see Frances later having buttons made and T-shirts made and things like that with her message, it's not unusual because my mother did that. And it's Frances may not have even realized, well, I'm doing this, I learned this because mother. But you just do. You just do. My mother saved articles and of interest to us and sent them periodically to us after we had left home. And my sister was constantly saving newspaper articles and underlining them and of interest and sending information out. And then Shirley, with her Cresswells Institute, she every month she gave a pack of articles, reprints of articles and other information to the attendees at the Cresswells Institute on the second Thursday of each month. So that was kind of like the same thing that my mom did. And also the fact that Frances taught through the Cresswells Institute, she was not just a psychiatrist, but she was a teacher. So when I moved back to Chicago back in 1993 to care for our mother, moved back from Washington, D.C., I became a founder of a school, a public school in Chicago. And so...
Was that Woodlawn Elementary?
It's Woodlawn Community School.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay.
Uh-huh. And so one is constantly, I guess, keeping one's finger in goals that have been created for you, so to speak.
And it certainly sounds like you and your family have not only stepped into those roles, but stepped into them with such grace and such passion and such power. You talked a moment ago about your sister Frances and her work. Talk to us a little bit about that. I know that you've just very recently lost two sisters. I'm so sorry.
Yeah, that's a deep groove that I have yet to contend with, really, really. But Well, what were you asking about Francis?
Just to tell us a bit about Francis's work.
Well, Francis, if you talk about Francis's work, you have to talk about, I started to say you have to talk about Neely Fuller, which one would have to talk about Francis meeting Neely Fuller and studying with him and helping to publish his epic work, United Independent Compensatory Code for Victims of White Supremacy. That work was very influential on Francis. However, I would say that before Neely, you would have to look at Francis's experiences and her general inquiry into systems of racism, although we were not using those terms. And when she finished Antioch College and wanted to go to Germany because she wanted to understand what had happened in Germany during the period of the war, the Second World War, and prior to that, when millions of people classified as Jewish people were exterminated. And she wanted to understand the psyche of those people who would permit such atrocity to happen. So she went to Germany with a kind of, work group and spent a summer there before she returned to Chicago and then went to and then went to Howard to medical school. So she was influenced by what she experienced, the people that she talked to, people who said they knew nothing about it, were not involved. But even prior to that, when she was still at Antioch, she had gone, and this was probably in 1950, I would say 53 or 54, she went with a group of students to Mexico, and she was the only African American with this group, and they drove down to Mexico from Ohio, and they were stopped several times because they were in a mixed, they were a mixed race group, and once they were taken to the police station and queried, they also had a lot of left-wing literature in their car. And I know they were stopped, I think, in Alabama and then also in Beaumont, Texas. I remember Beaumont especially. So this was an early experience of being arrested by police, supposedly, but primarily because they were an interracial group. They had gone into a restaurant, not knowing that, I think it was a black restaurant, but not knowing that this was something that they really was not permitted at that point in the South. And so those early experiences, I would say, then going to Germany, then later meeting Neely Fuller, had much to do with her development, her growth, and her inquiries into situations and conditions of race. But also, living in Chicago and growing up as we did in Chicago, we were very much aware of articles that appeared weekly in the Chicago Defender. And at that time, during our growing up period, 30s into the 40s and 50s, the Defender always had articles on issues of race and issues of who was being lynched or who had been lynched, mm-hmm. and lynchings in the South. So that was always a part of family discussion in our home. Our parents were, I would say, readers. Our parents were readers. And so we became readers. And we always had books in our home on all kinds of issues. And I mean, you know, back in those days, people talked about, you know, we came through Langston Hughes, many African American writers and poets were, if not available, we were known to us much more than I think people know of writers, African American writers, poets, and artists these days, because people really focused much more, I think, on learning more about the race. Also, I have said that back in, let's say, the excuse for lack of integration from white people, I would say, following the Civil War and coming up into the 1900s, white people told us, we were Negroes then, yes, well, we want you to be a part of us and part of our society, but you're not ready. You're just not ready.
You're not ready.
Pardon?
I was just quoting you. They told you that you just weren't, black people just were not ready to be a part of society?
Yes, yes. In other words, you weren't well educated. You didn't know how to talk. You were not ready to be a part of the broad society. That was the excuse that was given. And so many in the back in the day, when back at that time, many African American teachers and others felt it was their responsibility to get black people ready, black children ready. And so certainly people who had middle class aspirations, and I don't say that negatively, I just mean people who were moving from a level of poverty and margin into the, quote, middle class. People were becoming professionals. People were becoming business people. And so black teachers felt that their responsibility was to get children ready to be accepted into this integrated society that was going to come into existence. So part of readying you was to take piano lessons, music lessons, some kind of music lessons. You went to some concerts. You did different kinds of activities. Many of them, though, in the African-American community, plays. I remember we were in a play by Langston Hughes. We were little girls called Popo and Pepina. It was a wonderful play and musical. I've never seen it or heard of it since. But we were Francis and I were in that play, and we took dancing lessons from a African-American teacher. And so we were being readied, you know, that brought up to be accepted by white people. This is before we understood that was a big lie. It wasn't true. It wasn't going to happen. And we would have to really, really, really fight and struggle. But I think that some of Francis' earliest experiences in an integrated society was when she went to Antioch College in Yellow Springs, and she was one of maybe, I think there were only, that school worked on divisions, and I think there was one African American per division. And it was also the school from which Coretta King graduated. She was not Coretta King then, but I forget her maiden name, but Scott. And Frances said that as soon as she got to campus, people were asking her, well, do you know Corey Scott? You know, because, you know, that's the white people think that all black people know everybody.
Absolutely. If you
and
know,
so it doesn't
if
matter
you are
where
one, you know
you
everybody.
You could
yeah,
be, you
right.
know, you could be in Alaska and from Alaska, but somebody up there would, well, do you know Lauren Kress? Or do you know so-and-so? Somebody you never heard of, you know. But anyway, Frances always said, people, do you know Corey Scott? Because, you know, how we always are given nicknames.
Right.
And so she was Corey Scott. Do you know Corey Scott? Frances. But, so we were being readied, I would say, by, and not consciously, not real consciously, but just a little bit below the surface of consciousness, we were being readied to be accepted and integrated into this big world and this melting pot. Little did people know that all of that was a lie, so, and that it wasn't true, and that we didn't matter how well education could be denied. And then years later, when Frances published her first book, her Kress Theory of Color Confrontation, not only could you be denied because you were not, well, because you were, even though you were well prepared, once you were prepared and began to look at the situation for what it is, then you really could also be denied. So, I don't know if that responded to your question.
Absolutely. I mean, clearly there was no entry anywhere. And as you're talking about your sister Frances, of course, that is Dr. Frances Kress Welsing, who is a psychiatrist. And you are Lorne Kresslove, a community organizer, co-founder of a school, a figure in history by your own right. Tell us a little bit about your youngest sister, Barbara.
Well, wait a minute, because, you know, this community organized, I don't know where you got that from, but I don't know that I see myself as a community organizer, but I also am a founder of WPFW Radio, and I don't know if you know that, but I am one of the 9 people that put this radio station on the air. And I am very proud of that, because it was indeed a major struggle to get these airwaves open to African-American interest. And so I would say, in terms of my journey on, this is WPFW Radio is certainly one of the feathers that I proudly wear and continue to wear.
And
so now back to
well, you know what? I'm a take back community organizer. I stand corrected. But let's just talk a little bit about the creation of WPFW, which is radio in Washington D.C., which is part of the Pacifica Network. What was that experience like for you? I'm sure that people were just wanting to see a community radio station in Washington D.C., right?
No. I mean, I don't think that, no, I'm not sure that they were. I think that there may have been some people who were interested, but specifically Pacifica had for many years wanted a radio station in Washington, D.C., and was being constantly denied in many ways through government tampering and efforts, because of the history of Pacifica as being a very, very liberal, if not left-wing, organization, foundation that espoused causes that were sometimes alien to the powers that be, say, for instance, anti-war, racism, poverty, all Pacifica had a history of taking strong stands against various aspects of American life that were, I would say, dangerous. Pacifica was founded by a journalist named Lewis Hill, who went from Washington, D.C. to California. And at that time, the FM bands in town was just brand new. And Mr. Hill, and this was the end of the Second World War, and the horrors of Nagasaki, the horrors of atomic bomb, the horrors of the war generally. And Lewis Hill felt that radio could be used as a means of creating peace. And so that's where the word Pacifica came from, although many people think it came from the fact that the first two stations were started on the east in California, but no, it was really the idea of peace and using the airwaves. And so Pacifica was the first organization or developed a foundation which acquired KPFA, KPFK, the station in Houston whose call letters I do forget now, WBAI in New York, and they wanted to start a radio station in Washington, D.C. And so in the late 60s, Phil Watson came from California to Washington, D.C. to do the early investigation of the possibilities of creating a radio station in D.C. And that was denied, so Pacifica first put a news bureau in Washington that fed to the other Pacifica stations. And that was in, I think, maybe around the late 60s, since they didn't get the radio station. And then in the 70s, there was another attempt to start or to acquire a license and a channel on the FM band. And as Phil did this work and was beginning to be successful, someone in the federal government spoke to Howard and asked Howard University to challenge the Pacifica license request on the grounds that there was no channel on that FM band that was that blacks owned. And so Howard did challenge Pacifica's request for the license, and so it was again held up.
Interesting.
But then in 70, I'm not good on these dates now, but then maybe 68, 69, around that time, the federal government was requiring news organizations to divest. In other words, if you had a radio station and a television station and a newspaper in a single town, you were being required to divest some of those entities. In other words, because you were being accused of controlling all the news. The Washington Post newspaper, they had Channel 9 television, they had an AM station, they had an FM station, they had Newsweek magazine. So they were, Washington Post Corporation was required to divest of some of those entities. So what they did was they traded their television station, I think, was a station in Detroit. They had an AM and FM stations, so they gave their FM station to Howard University. And that, once Howard received that station from the Washington Post, their challenge to Pacifica became moot. So Phil Watson, who had done the original work for Pacifica, to get a station, the feds were still not willing to grant that station. So Phil went to W8 over to Howard and started Howard Station, WHUR, on the programming format that was originally established by Pacifica of music, art, talk, drama, public affairs. Phil took that concept to WHUR and started that station, and originally it was a non-commercial station. Its logo was 360 degrees of the black experience, because that's kind of what Pacifica's concept of media was, 360 degrees of media, of radio. Phil started WHUR, and WHUR operated as a non-commercial station for maybe 2 years. And I remember when Phil turned the station around and turned it into a commercial station. I was in his office when he said that this is what was going to happen, and I said, well, it will never be the same. It is a good station, but it was never the same as it was when it first started, when it was not, was commercial free and somewhat independent. So back to WPFW, once the Howard University's challenge became moot, then it the possibility of Pacifica getting this station was much more possible. That is a long story, and there were lots of other challenges,
you know,
that occurred.
One of the things that it certainly speaks to, I think, is the importance of community radio, and certainly the importance of WPFW, and the real need for the community to actively support WPFW, because so much energy went into creating it, and clearly there have been so many roadblocks to its creation from the very beginning.
Yes. Well, I would say that several things that WPFW experienced entering the airwaves in Washington, D.C., that PFW is responsible for saving jazz in the nation's capital, and probably broadly. When we came on the air, and the question, when I was asked to be a part of the founding staff of PFW, the first question I asked was, what was the music going to be? And I didn't ask how much money will you pay or anything. What's the music going to be? And when I was told that it was going to be jazz, I said, fine, I'm signing up. Because and at that time, there was one jazz club left in D.C. And I forget the name of that club now, but the music was fading. The music was fading. PFW came on the air and announced its presence by playing Duke Ellington's A Train. And I remember people saying, they were, you know, going down there, down, all of a sudden they heard A Train blasting out. They couldn't believe it. Somebody said they almost stopped their car in the middle of the street. You know, they could not believe it. Here was jazz on public airwaves. And that was one of our major commitments to the music and to the culture. We literally saved the music. We didn't. You have to talk to many of the programmers,
yes,
and musicians in this town who can say how PFW has helped them and has helped their careers. And it's not just careers that are being helped, but it's vibe in the universe. You know, jazz and the creative music of African Americans is very important. Sound is very important.
Absolutely.
And so when you're putting certain kinds of sounds and energy into the universe, it affects people's lives. And, you know, I can tell the difference in my own sense and my own self when I hear some kind, different kinds of music. So I know what jazz does. I know what this creative music does.
And it has a powerful impact on one's emotional well-being,
exactly.
on one's mental health.
Yes, exactly.
Lauren, we're going to take a break for a moment, and then we'll be right back to continue our conversation. Folks, this is Pamela Brewer. You're listening to Mind Talk. Please don't go any place. We will continue with Lauren Kresslove. I'd like to switch gears a little bit and talk about the impact from your perspective of racism on the mental health of persons of color, specifically African Americans.
So how much time do we have?
Oh, about 18 years maybe.
Well, yeah, that's a very deep subject.
Yes.
And I say that the impact of racism on people of color started when slaves were, or Africans were kidnapped, and one way or another began to be marched to the coast of Africa, countries, African countries, and put on slave ships. That's, I would say, the beginning of the impact on our mental health. Because there's a continuum. See, there's not been a moment stop in time since the first African was put on a slave ship. And life is a continuum. And experiences are continuous from parent to child, from parent to child, from parent to child. There's not been a break in our history and in our time. In my history, in your history, there's not been a break since your ancestors were brought here in slave ships and forced to undergo the horrors of the Middle Passage. So we don't really think about the impact of the kidnap and enslavement as part of our history, but we're connected. There's not been a, and just because we don't know who the ancestor was, doesn't mean that we didn't have an ancestor.
That's true.
It just means that we don't know their names. And we don't know those great-great-great-great-great-grandparents, grandmothers and grandfathers who endured the horrors of that Middle Passage, chained in those dungeons. I mean, what was their condition, mental condition, when they came off of the boat. What were their thoughts? What were their feelings? We still embed those thoughts and feelings, whether we're conscious of it or not, so that we have to take ourselves back to almost back to Africa to begin to undo or to assuage the pain. We have not, because we learn in the Western tradition, like Kaji Woodson talked about the miseducation of the Negro. We are so miseducated, but not just us, everybody is, because the information and the lines and the history that was distorted when Alexander went into Egypt and stole the and burned, killed the priests and stole the books and et cetera, et cetera. That break in the understanding of history and the human condition was brought as a part of the Western tradition of thinking, and that's why it's so stupid. And that's why we're in the dilemma that we're in terms of war, in terms of the environment, because it's all compartmentalized, and we're not taught to understand everything is everything. Everything is everything. So in terms of our history, we're still suffering from being kidnapped. We're still denying that we're Africans. And I say that either you're from slavery or you're from Africa. Choose. Now, if you choose Africa, then you need to somehow make a hook, identify yourself with a country or not a country, but just with the idea of us being the original people, the mothers and fathers of civilization, because that's who we are.
Absolutely.
And then we need to figure out why we are here, because there must be a cosmic reason for us being here.
You know, I was doing a program sometime back, and we were talking about, actually, as I think about it now, I was actually doing a program specifically around your sister, Dr. Frances Cress Welsing, and her loss and her teachings, and talking about the need, as you said, I mean, the need for us to celebrate and respect ourselves in a way that too often we don't. And I can't tell you the number of emails that I got from folks annoyed because it seemed like I was quote unquote dissing white people. It was really quite something that there is this sense that if we are going to be proud and respectful of ourselves and our own resources and our own resilience, that somehow that means that we are opposed to somebody else, when in fact that's kind of what other people do.
Well, let me say this about dissing white people. I am dissed as a black person every single day of the year in America. When I turn on the television, when I open magazines, when I open books, I am constantly dissed by the lack of including people of color in publications, on television, in important roles. You know, like we got 40-something congresspeople, black congresspeople, in the Congress of the United States. How many times do you ever see one of them referenced for some information? Never, hardly ever. You know, so how many times are other African-American people of import and great knowledge referenced around any situation? So I am constantly dissed, and I feel dissed. When I open a magazine and I'm told that here's the most beautiful woman in the world and she's white-skinned and straight yellow hair, I'm dissed. How could she be the most beautiful person in the world when maybe I should be, or some other woman of color? What about our men who are constantly dissed when all the great white hope of America are white? No, we're always dissed. So no one has an right to talk about their diss. We're all black people are dissed in this country every single day of the year, constantly dissed, not just by police, but by every element of life in America. And until black people start talking about that and resisting being dissed, they'll continue to be dissed.
One of the requests that I asked during that program was that as we think about ourselves as people of color, as African Americans, that we stop getting caught up in who looks like what and what complexion who is and what kind of hair he or she has. Because it's still so much, it seems to me, a part of the world in which we live. And I, quite frankly, don't think we need to help other people hurt us.
Well, until we get deeply in love with ourselves and every aspect of our beingness, we're going to still have these problems. And until we really understand why these problems exist and then figure out how to bypass them by loving ourselves more, feeling good about ourselves more, respecting ourselves more, then we're going to continue to have these problems. I mean, I think that the major problem that we have is how we see ourselves and how we feel about ourselves. And these ideas and attitudes were forced on us. So it's really difficult to get out of it. But we have to find the means to do that.
Because that is our survival.
Yes.
We know you and I have been talking for a while now, and we have certainly made several references to the loss of your sisters. As you move forward now in your own life, what would you like, or is there anything that you would like from listeners, from just sort of people who have loved your family and your sisters and you around the world? What will help you in your time of grief and healing?
You want to know the real truth?
Yes.
Birthday cards.
Okay.
I'll be 82 on the 31st of March. And only today or yesterday did I realize that, you know, my sisters always sent me birthday cards, and we always sent birthday cards to each other. And, you know, I don't have sisters anymore. And this is really, you know, I'm sure that there's deep grief that I have not even tapped into out of fear. I do know that one can heal, and that one does heal, and that one heals, especially if one acknowledges that one needs to heal. So I don't fear that at all, but I do know that I thought about it today and yesterday. Wow, my birthday is coming up, and I don't have any sisters to send me birthday cards. So anyone who wants to send me a birthday card can send it to me.
And how might they send it to you?
Well, they can send it to me at Dr. Wellsman's address, which is, gee, I don't even know the address at this minute. I've really drawn a blank. I don't know where I live. Hold on.
Folks, you are listening to a conversation with Lorne Kresloff.
I cannot believe that I cannot, that I've forgotten where I live.
I have to tell you that your memory skills actually astound me anyway. So I kind of want whatever you're taking, because your memory skills are blowing me away. So if you can't pull up an address right this minute, that is perfectly fine. We can work that one out. are you in
6025 16th Street Northwest?
6025 16th Street Northwest. Okay.
20011. I want people to support WPFW. I really do. And it's not because I am one of the founders of that radio station, but it's because it's an important entity in our community, and I want people to support that station. And that's what I'm also going to spend some time addressing.
Wonderful.
How can we help make this station better and better and better?
Wonderful. Thank you so much for that. Certainly, as we've said, WPFW is an icon in the community and needs to remain so and to become stronger and stronger. So thank you for that as well.
Well, thank you.
All right. Lauren Kress-Love, I'm going to let you go. But again, thank you for your time today and for the work that you're doing.
And I thank you. And I thank you for the work that you're doing. It's very important.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. You have been listening to part one of a conversation with Lauren Kress-Love, who is the sister of the late Dr. Frances Kress-Welsing. Lauren Kress-Love is a powerhouse for civil rights in her own right. She is a staunch advocate for African American media. She is indeed a leader for the ages. And you have heard Lauren Kress-Love say that what would be wonderful for her, what would help her as she goes through her own grief and her own healing as she deals with the loss of her sister, Dr. Frances Kress-Welsing, is birthday cards. Lauren Kress-Love's birthday is March 31st. The address to send those birthday cards to is 6025 16th Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20011-1713. Let's make this a good day for Lauren Kress-Love. Birthday cards are her request that will help her with her healing. 6025 16th Street Northwest in Washington, D.C. And thank you for listening to this edition of Mind Talk. Mind Talk is brought to you daily as an educational public service. It is not intended to replace any work that you might choose to do with a medical, mental health, or other professional of your choosing. Mind Talk is available to you on demand at myndtalk.org. Mind Talk is produced by Jim Brown and 26x2 Communications. If you would like to be in touch with me directly, that number is 301-654-5286. The best way to be in touch is by going to myndtalk.org. And folks, always remember, if it's unacceptable, then it's unacceptable. Thank you.
that he is in that office.
That is so true. And I am, you know, I'm thinking about the folks who, the post-racial crew, you know, you have to at least acknowledge that they exist. And that in and of itself,
well,
but you
I
tell me
know.
How
I,
it strikes
see, I don't
you.
Know. Any post-racial people, maybe because of my age group, we just not into post-racial.
You know better, but, huh?
But there's no such thing as post-racial. That's just hope. That's fear. That's hope and fear. And that's people who think that they're moving into situations, oh, well, let's ask them where they live. Where do these people live? Where are they trying to live? And are they still trying to live in Washington, D.C., or other inner cities where we're being forced out of by something called gentrification, which is really a major white supremacist activity? Ask them how much they're paying for rent, or can they even buy where they want to buy?
Absolutely.
In their post-racial America.
Gotcha. I'm thinking that you're thinking it doesn't exist. Is that a fair observation?
Listen, you got it. It's a dream. It's a dream by someone having a nightmare that they don't want to confront.
What do we need to do as a people? What do we need to do to protect our mental health, to protect our emotional wellness, to survive?
Well, I think that in order to protect one's mental health, one has to understand who one is and where one is. And so it's like find out who you are and then find out where you are. And if we understand who we are, if we embrace ourselves, we have substantively embrace ourselves, which is not easy, because it's not easy to, you know, look at your black face in the mirror and then see the beauty when you've been, you know, in programmed, literally programmed to see something else as beauty. You have to, you know, it's like going on the inside of your mind and scraping stuff away. It is not an easy task to come into your sense of self. That is hard work. And we have not had the programs available to us on a large scale that can help us do that. But that has to be done. I mean, we have to almost like go back to Africa and kiss the ground and then come back. And have some people say, welcome home, we're sorry we let you go, and then decide to come back to America to really get whole. Because we're the only group of people in this country who did not come here from someplace else on their own volition. Everybody else in this country who they themselves or their ancestors or others came here from someplace else on a decision to come here from someplace else for all the same reasons. I don't care what language they speak. They all come here saying either I or my grandfather, my great-grandfather, great-great, however, came to America to make a better life for themselves. Now, the only group of people who did not do that are us, the descendants of people who were enslaved, kidnapped and enslaved Africans. We did not come here on that purpose line. And so, to some extent, we're still trying to wonder why we're here. You know, that's why we keep saying, what's happening? What's going on? Because we ain't in it, and we don't know. And we didn't come here on that dream. And we have not changed our minds. You can transform, be ye transformed, Romans 12:2. Be ye transformed by the renewal of your mind. Now, that is what we need to do, because we need to understand that we didn't come here on our own purpose, and we're still operating on somebody else's purpose, even to this very moment.
Lauren Cresswelsing, I would like to, I'm sorry, I changed your name.
That's okay.
Lauren Cresslove. I would like to, with your permission, read a Pledge of Allegiance for Black People that your sister, Dr. Frances Cresswelsing, wrote. May I?
Yes.
It is entitled, A Black Oath, A Pledge of Allegiance for Black People. I pledge allegiance to my own black self-respect and to the self-respect of all other black and shades of black people on planet Earth, all of whom are victims of the system of racism, white supremacy. And I pledge to use all of my life energy, intelligence, and creativity in all areas of people activity to eliminate the global system of racism, white supremacy on planet Earth and to replace it with justice so that there can be peace. So help me God. And again, this was written by Dr. Frances Cresswelsing. Lauren, what's your feeling as you hear her oath?
Well, I think that it's courageous. It's genius. And I think that black people and people of color everywhere ought to adopt that pledge and that oath and wake up every morning and repeating it to themselves as they start out their day of dealing in a country or in a world that still is attempting to deny their greatness.
I would also like to suggest that as this oath is repeated on a daily basis, that it's done so looking in the mirror at your own reflection.
Mm-hmm.
I think that could be a very powerful experience. Just to say, I pledge allegiance to my own black self-respect.
Mm-hmm.
And to the respect of all other black and shades of black people on the planet Earth. If that's all you feel like you have time to say, that in and of itself is a powerful reminder.
I agree. And I'm very glad that you read it. You know, you did read the oath and the prayer that Frances also wrote at the memorial service. And, you know, that really speaks to her genius. You know, she, not only did she write a book, not only did she write, you know, her first small pamphlet, The Crest Theory, and then the ISIS papers, but she was constantly thinking of ways to help us develop stronger sense of self. And she never stopped. Frances never stopped creating, thinking, how can I help my people? So I thank you so much for reading that oath, and I hope that people will get copies of it and to learn it and repeat it as you suggested. I think that's a wonderful idea.
And Lauren, what I would like to read again with your permission is the prayer, a liberating black people's prayer for justice and peace.
Yes.
And this is to be said and envisioned when in prayer, and it reads thusly, Thou who art blacker than a trillion midnights, whose eyes shine brighter than a billion suns, Thou whose hair doth coil tighter than a million springs, radiating all energy throughout the universe, we beseech Thee, one and only one, to give us total strength to carry out Thy will for the universe, to establish justice on planet Earth, and live in peace. This was written by Dr. Frances Cresswelsing in 1996. Lauren?
Mm-hmm, yes.
What are your thoughts?
Well, we read that at the memorial, and the fact that she says to to be read while envisioning, while seeing, and taking what one sees in, you know, thou who art blacker than, what is it, a trillion midnights, or, I mean, I think that the wording and the idea and the concept is marvelous and is substantive. We need to begin to see ourselves as marvelous and as beautiful in our own color, and in our own hair that coils like springs. These were words that she used so that we would begin to see and appreciate ourselves and our difference as beautiful and marvelous. We have to do that if we are to regain sanity. Because as long as we're attempting to mimic someone else and to be like someone else, we are insane. And I would say that a psychiatrist's duty was to help heal mental illness. And so certainly her poem and her oath were a part of that mission.
And a mission certainly that was well energized, not only by herself and her own passion, but I know the passion of the Kress family. It sounds like the Kress family has been on a mission for a very long time.
Right, I guess maybe ever since great-grandfather came down from Canada to fight in the Civil War, you know, we have had our mission forwarded. Frances felt that she had a cosmic assignment, and that her mission was, as it was a cosmic assignment assigned from the Creator. And I think that she was right. And so we intend to continue that mission by making more of her work available and making her tapes available to people, her lectures, so that people can really read and study. I say that not just for Frances's work, but the work of many of our scholars. You know, people buy the books, but we don't study the books. We don't study the books. We buy them and they sit on the shelf. So we need to really go back and study. What were these people really saying? What was their charge? What was Carter G. Woodson's charge to us? What was he talking about? Why did he say miseducation of the Negro? And how come we haven't taken him more seriously? You know, that book is as old as I am, you know, and that's getting up there. It's older than me.
Just a little bit.
It was published in 1933.
Lauren, tell us about the Kress-Welsing Institute.
Well, the Institute was founded by Frances. It came out of a series of lectures that she and Neely Fuller did way back, just as the Kress Theory was published, and even before that, just as people were helping Neely to publish and get his writings in the United Independent Compensatory Code for Victims of White Supremacy. Neely and Frances lectured together or up at Howard at various buildings, and then at some point, and I don't remember exactly when that was, Frances began to lecture or began to conceptualize the concept of the Institute. I don't know the exact dates that happened, but I do know that I moved to D.C. in 1970. No, 70. I moved here in 72. And she was beginning to lecture at, I think, the Howard Inn, and forming the Institute, developing the kind of framework for what was ultimately called the Kressel-Welsing Institute. Now, that went on the second Thursday of every month from September to June for about 30 years at Howard. And there are students and people who have studied with Francis for well over 20 years.
And we're talking about Howard University in Washington,
D.C. Yeah, Howard University in Washington, D.C.
Mm-hmm.
She began giving her lectures there at the Blackburn Center and has been lecturing. And the Institute really consisted just of Dr. Welsing in terms of lecturing. And she used that opportunity to explain her theory and how it works and what it does, what it means in the lives of us, every month, the second Thursday, as I said. She also, part of the program was the distribution of a pamphlet of papers, which were reprints of various articles from newspapers or other printed material that was reflective of her theory on racism, white supremacy, whether it was for or against. And so Frances would call newspapers, other people would send her information, and then she would have these articles reprinted in her packet of information that was a part of, a regular part of the Institute. So that's basically what the Institute was and is. What form it will take now that Francis is no longer among us is not totally decided, but people who are members of the Institute certainly want it to continue. So we will be working together to see how we can make this new edition of the Institute work.
Mm-hmm. I'm wondering, Lauren, if you can talk for a little bit about your sister's stay at Howard University.
About her stay, you say, at Howard?
Yeah.
Well, Francis was, a graduate of the medical school and had been hired to teach she's a graduate of Howard, she was teaching in the medical school, and it was at the time, around that time, and I don't have the years, that somewhat around that time that she met Neely Fuller. And Neely, Francis began to study with Neely Fuller and his theories on racism, white supremacy, and his United Independent Code for victims of racism, white supremacy. And people have to read Neely Fuller because his philosophy, his theory, is profound. Frances began to, as a result of her studying and understanding Neely's definition of racism, white supremacy, and what it is and how it works, as a psychiatrist, she began to ask the question, why? If there is such a thing as a sense of superiority, why would these people think that they were superior to other human beings? And what is it that would make them feel that different. And as she began to look across the board, she said that the only difference that she could determine that made people who lacked skin color different was that they did lack skin color. So my father, who was a physician, as was his father also, but my father said to Francis, who wondered about this lack of skin color, look at the melanocyte. Look at the melanocyte. And Francis did, and she began to understand where color comes from, and that the lack of color is a recessive trait. It's really albinism. That's what lack of color is, albinism, and it's lack of ability to produce melanin. And that it's a recessive trait, and that if a person of color and a person who lacks color come together through a sexual act, the result is going to be a person of color. And so Francis began to say that this was, that racism, white supremacy, is, as the brothers, fear of the black planet, fear of losing their racial identity, fear of racial annihilation, and so that the rest of the colored world is being held at bay by a small minority of people on the planet Earth who really number one-tenth of the world's population. So that was the beginning of her theory, on the Kress theory of color confrontation. When she, while she's still teaching at Howard, she's teaching at Howard and has developed this theory, which she was quite proud of. But as she presented her paper to various people at the university, she began to, find rejection. And she was actually told by the head of the medical school not to publish her paper, which she did, and the rest is history. She was not given tenure, and she left Howard University as a teacher.
Mm-hmm. Thank you for sharing that part of history with us. We know you and I have been talking for a while now, and we have certainly made several references to the loss of your sisters. As you move forward now in your own life, what would you like, or is there anything that you would like from listeners, from just sort of people who have loved your family and your sisters and you around the world? What will help you in your time of grief and healing?
You want to know the real truth?
Yes.
Birthday cards.
Okay.
I'll be 82 on the 31st of March. And only today or yesterday did I realize that, you know, my sisters always sent me birthday cards, and we always sent birthday cards to each other. And, I don't have sisters anymore. And this is really, I'm sure that there's deep grief that I have not even tapped into out of fear. I do know that one can heal, and that one does heal, and that one heals, especially if one acknowledges that one needs to heal. So I don't fear that at all, but I do know that I thought about it today and yesterday. Wow, my birthday is coming up, and I don't have any sisters to send me birthday cards. So anyone who wants to send me a birthday card, can send it to me.
And how might they send it to you?
Well, they can send it to me at Dr. Wellsman's address, which is, gee, I don't even know the address at this minute. I've really drawn a blank. I don't know where I live. Hold on.
Folks, you are listening to a conversation with Lorne Kress.
I cannot believe that I cannot, forgotten where I live.
I have to tell you that your memory skills actually astound me anyway. So I kind of want whatever you're taking because your memory skills are blowing me away. So if you can't pull up an address right this minute, that is perfectly fine. We can work that one out. are you in
6025 16th Street Northwest?
6025 16th Street Northwest. Okay.
20011.
Are you in the D.C. area for a while now?
I'm back and forth between here and Chicago, so I almost don't know, you know, when I'm leaving here and going back to Chicago. I don't have a set plan just yet, but I will be here for a while, yes.
Okay.
And I'll be here back and forth here. Mm-hmm.
As we wrap up our conversation today, and I know that I have kept you long after the time that we agreed, that you agreed on, so I appreciate your patience. Is there anything more that you would like to say to your sisters or to the listeners?
Well, what I'd like to say to my sisters is that I definitely love them and miss them. You know, the three of us, it's like in any family, different people play different roles in a family, and some people take on this, and some people take on that, and some people take on the other. Well, with the three of us, we had always been, if something was going on with one of us, then there were the other two to deal with it. And so that up until my sister Barbara's death in February, at least, you know, she was there once Francis died. But now it's like you turn to the left and right, and so there's no one there, but they are there. And so I send them love. And what I want people to do as far as the memory of Frances Welsing is concerned is to read her book and to understand what she was attempting to tell us about where we are. If we can understand where we are, that this is not the land of the free and the home of the brave. You know, it's really a land of cowards and people who have refused to step forward and look at the truth and look at the truth of their history and then to make some apology in some way and say, we are sorry, and to work to change their own minds, just as we as African-American people have had to suffer and work to change our minds about the programming that was put on us. So my wish is that people would study Frances, but not just Frances. Any black writer and educator, pick up a book, and let's move away from these television programs that really only demean us ultimately. I mean, they're set up, they're glamorous, they're, oh my God. But are they helping us free ourselves? I don't think so. So I think we people need to get back to books and read and improve their beingness. We have to improve our beingness so that we are strong, our backs are straight, and we're able to face this critical question of racism, white supremacy, and with dignity, with great self-respect. Because once we respect ourselves and love ourselves enough, no two things can occupy the same space at the same time. So we will meet this challenge and we will be victorious.
And on that, I will simply reread a sentence from your sister, Dr. Frances Cress Welsing's Black Oath, just to remind folks. As she wrote, I pledge allegiance to my own Black self-respect and to the respect of all other Black and shades of Black people on the planet Earth. From Dr. Frances Cress Welsing, Lorne Cress, love, thank you, thank you, thank you for your time today, for all of the work that you have done. Do you have any sense of what's in the future for you?
A lot of work in pushing my sister's work forward.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, you've certainly got a lot available to you to do.
You know what's in the future for me? Another thing I'll tell you. I want people to support WPFW. I really do. And it's not because I am one of the founders of that radio station, but it's because it's an important entity in our community, and I want people to support that station. And that's what I'm also going to spend some time addressing.
Wonderful.
How can we help make this station better and better and better?
Wonderful. Thank you so much for that. Certainly, as we've said, WPFW is an icon in the community and needs to remain so and to become stronger and stronger. So thank you for that as well.
Well, thank you.
All right. Lorne Cress Love, I'm going to let you go. But again, thank you for your time today and for the work that you're doing.
And I thank you. And I thank you for the work that you're doing. It's very important.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Bye-bye.
Folks, thank you for joining us on this edition of Mind Talk. Mind Talk is produced by Jim Brown and 26x2 Communications. Mind Talk is available to you daily on demand at myndtalk.org. That's myndtalk.org. If you would like to be in touch with me directly, that number is 301-654-5286. That's 301-654-5286. The best way to be in touch, though, is through the website, and that is myndtalk.org. Mind Talk is provided daily as an educational public service. It is not intended to replace any work that you may choose to do with a licensed medical, mental health, or other professional. And folks, just a reminder, if it's unacceptable, it's unacceptable. Take care.